Wonderful it is to be here in a nation with such a long and distinguished history and tradition of scholarship into language, such wonderful traditions of philosophy and linguistics and philology and research. I'm exceptionally grateful to Professor Li Fuyin for organizing this. Everybody clap for Li Fuyin. Yeah. And to all these wonderful volunteers, and now to prove to you that I do not speak Mandarin, I am going to try to read their names. And I want them to stand up so we can acknowledge them. Hu Yanan, are you here somewhere? You must be. Chen Mo. Is Chen Mo here? They're all outside. So later on, at the end of the talk, when they're actually in here listening, I'll acknowledge everybody. But they're a wonderful group of people. Chen Mo, Li Lingmen, Mai Sai, Wang Fan, Wu Shan, Xiong Li Qin, Yang Qie, Yan Shu Ying, Yuan Wenjuan, Zheng Ling Yan. Thank you all for the wonderful help that you have given us and for making this conference possible. But I also want to thank all of the participants, because it's quite amazing that you are here. This is Dragon Boat Festival weekend. And this is of the holidays that are observed in China. I am told that this is the very oldest. And you could be home, all of you, eating the zhongzi and drinking yellow wine, right? But no, you have come to study cognitive linguistics here at Beihan University, so we must be particularly respectful of the sacrifice you are making to come here, and so I will have to try to give good lectures in honor of Chu Yuan, the great poet, who was a great student of language and practitioner of language, and also a very dedicated man. I will do my best in these lectures. Otherwise, perhaps the dragon will come eat me. Now, it is very important that we establish an international community in cognitive linguistics to build on the work that has gone before. And China has become a great leader in cognitive linguistics in its own national efforts and through the efforts of the participants in this audience and in other capitals and of provinces in China and other cities. And we are now hoping to develop more programs for students throughout the world and to create a basis for research and collaboration. I'm hoping that at some point, since Beihan University and Professor Li Fuyin have become such great leaders in cognitive linguistics, that maybe someday we will see a doctoral program here located in Beijing, which will be one of the great things to celebrate in cognitive linguistics in the world. At Case Western Reserve University, where I work, we have a program. We offer an MA in cognitive linguistics. This is the first year that we have offered it. We have our first class of students. They are from all around the world and they work with us. We have visitors who are postgraduate students and professors and who work with us and come to work in our workshop. They come from Brazil and Portugal, from Denmark and Germany, from Spain, from all over, and we have two Chinese scholars who are working with us in our workshop now. In fact, we have quite a large community and many more applications. It's possible to come and study cognitive linguistics at Case Western Reserve University at the graduate level. You call it postgraduate for a master's degree. And if you look on the website under cognitive linguistics, you will find the program and what it does and what the syllabus is and how people study. We, of course, use in this program the wonderful Oxford Handbook of Cognitive Linguistics, co-edited by my esteemed colleague here, Dirk Herarts. I'm very grateful to him, too, for having done such a superb job of giving a broad picture of the role of cognitive linguistics. So the question that we are here to try to answer at the beginning is, what is cognitive linguistics? What is language? What is the nature of this enterprise? And I would say, in a way, I think the consolidation of efforts has gone sufficiently far that it's almost possible to drop the word cognitive from cognitive linguistics, because we see a great influence of cognitive linguistics and a great ability to combine a number of different fields. In cognitive linguistics, broadly, the view is that language is a branch of cognition. Language is a branch of mind. It is not a separate, partitioned, modular activity that can be studied on its own. And of course, that is not... Lynn Talmy, for example, who was a speaker in this series, my good friend, Lynn, says at the beginning of his book, Towards a Cognitive Semantics, that he doesn't know why he's using the word cognitive, because, of course, semantics is always cognitive. So he should just have called it Toward a Theory of Semantics. And we don't want to be that immediate in dropping the word cognitive. We do want to continue to push on the principle that language is a branch of the mind. Now, this is not surprising when you think of it. Evolution is a tinker. The great evolutionary biologist François Jacob described evolution as a tinker. A tinker takes things that are available and builds on them, modifies them just a little, tries to fit them together in order to achieve new things. Now, of course, in doing that, there may be some emergent structure. There may be some emergent phenomena. But evolution does not start from scratch, or at least someone who maintains that evolution has started from scratch for a particular activity has a great deal of explaining to do, because that is not the principal way that evolutionary biology works. There are many different evolutionary mechanisms, and most of them indicate the ways in which evolution is a tinker. We are here to talk about cognitive science, cognitive linguistics, and the study of the distinctiveness of human beings. Now, one way to look at the distinctiveness of human beings is to observe all the things that they can do that other species can't do, and then try to figure out how each one came about. And to take each one, art, music, language, fashions of dress, advanced social cognition, advanced tool use, and so on. And then to break them into parts and to figure out how each of those parts works and hope that a human being is a linear sum of all these little parts, that a human being is a combination of all these little parts. And so I would like to suggest that that is, in many ways, a questionable way to approach the study of human cognition. And the quotation that I will read to you to give you a sense of my perspective on this comes from the great neuroscientist V.S. Ramachandran in Phantoms in the Brain. He wrote, "For over half a century, modern neuroscience has been on a reductionist path, breaking things down into ever smaller parts with the hope that understanding all of the little pieces will eventually explain the whole. Unfortunately, many people think that because reductionism is so often useful in solving problems, it is therefore also sufficient for solving them. And generations of neuroscientists have been raised on this dogma. This misapplication of reductionism leads to the perverse and tenacious belief that somehow reductionism itself will tell us how the brain works, when what is really needed are attempts to bridge different levels of discourse. The Cambridge physiologist Horace Barlow recently pointed out at a scientific meeting that we have spent 5 decades studying the cerebral cortex in excruciating detail, but we still don't have the foggiest idea of how it works or what it does. He shocked the audience by suggesting that we are all like asexual Martians visiting Earth who spend 50 years examining the detailed cellular mechanisms and biochemistry of the testicles without knowing anything at all about sex. And this is in many ways the sorrow of the reductionist path in the study of higher order human cognition. Human higher order cognition is a great complex. Now, we have had the question even today, is it not ambitious to try to explain all of these at once? But let us look at the fact that a human being is a seamless whole. A human being does not have one brain when it's doing mathematics, a different brain when it is speaking language, a different brain with different abilities when it is engaging in social cognition, a different brain when it is walking. A human brain is a seamless system, and human higher order cognitive abilities come up together. They come up together in the infant. The infant learns all of these things simultaneously. It may well be that it would be impossible to learn these individual behaviors if you had to learn them separately. But they all help each other. Social cognition helps language. Walking helps social cognition. Vision helps social cognition. Gesture helps language. All of these things work together. It is not clear that it is easier to explain them separately than it is to explain them as a unified set of abilities that human beings have, that they developed evolutionarily, phylogenetically, and that they develop in a lifetime, ontogenetically. And this is indeed sort of what we're going to look at. Now, it's not so difficult these days to find these sorts of views expressed very widely in the study of language. Lynn Talmy's work, for example, has become quite popular and routinely referred to in successors to transformational generative principles and parameters linguistics. Noam Chomsky himself, in an article with W. Tecumseh Fitch and Mark Hauser in 2002, talking about what might be exclusive to language, that is, in this science article, argues that it might be that the only thing that is exclusive to language, that is, the only ability that is not shared with many other cognitive abilities, is recursion, our old classic recursion. But then says, and maybe not even recursion, because recursion can come from navigation behavior in animals that need to search and locate for food. Of course, this article spawned a great debate. You're all familiar with that debate. But the idea that language is a branch of higher order human cognition, that it draws upon and cooperates with other human abilities, is by now no longer a minority position. It's very common across the study of linguistics generally. In fact, I wonder if in 50 years it will not be the case that people were wondering what the debate was about anyway. Just where did these people disagree? The disagreement has never been about whether human beings are uniquely equipped for language, or whether this is biological. Of course, in some sense, they are uniquely equipped for language. And of course, it is biological. What else could it be? If you have a frog and a human baby, the frog will never learn language, no matter what you do. The human baby will learn language if it is born into anything like a human community. And this is naturally because of their biological endowments. There is no doubt about that. The question is rather whether or not our ability for language draws upon other cognitive capacities and other mechanisms, or is it an autonomous capacity? And I think the evidence you hear presented in these lectures and the research broadly in linguistics is moving and has moved every year, every 5 years, more and more in the direction of recognizing that human beings are complex adaptive systems that develop a great range of capabilities, and that it is, of course, natural and to be expected that higher order human capacities draw upon capacities that are deep in the evolutionary line. So the programs are advancing, but now we need a place where we can publish all of this vibrant research and your great papers and all of the things that are happening in the world. And this needs to be quick, and it needs to be free, and it needs to be open access, and it needs to be such that the authors, you, retain the copyright. Now, we have some good journals, of course. We have Cognitive Linguistics, which is a rigorously peer-reviewed journal. We have the new, wonderful International Cognitive Linguistics Journal, edited by Professor Li Fuyin. But I want to make you aware of another possibility that is brand new. There is a worldwide research network called the Social Science Research Network. And it is a online service by academics for academics. It is always free to upload your research. It is always free to search the research other people have uploaded. It is always free to download the research that they have uploaded. And it is a great success over the last 12 years in law and business and economics and political science. And the Social Science Research Network has just created a cognitive science network. And one of its branches is cognitive linguistics. And you see its website here. If you just go to ssrn.com, you will see this service. You can click on cognitive science. There are already 250,000 papers posted on the Social Science Research Network. They are free. This is an old slide. There have been now 28 million downloads of these papers. And this is what the Cognitive Science Network looks like. Now, the Cognitive Science Network is not for profit. It's pro bono. I am its director, and I take no salary. This is a purely research activity. It never takes copyright. You can always upload papers, search, and download papers free. You retain the copyright. You retain the rights. If you want to take your paper down, that's just fine. Leave an abstract. Across the entire world, we don't know of a single print journal that regards putting something on the Cognitive Science Network as publication, so you're free to publish your papers in journals later. You can remove your papers at any time or leave an abstract and a link. And this is important. Papers can be posted in any language, certainly including Mandarin. All you have to provide is an English translation of the title and an English translation of the abstract, little paragraph. That's all. So when you go to my webpage, for instance, you see various articles, and next to the articles you'll see CSN version. And if you click on the CSN version, it takes you to my author page. Remember, this is all free. You could set up your SSRN CSN author page if you had online access, wireless. You could do this right now in 10 seconds. Everyone could do this now in 10 seconds. When you click, so here are some more of my papers on the Cognitive Science Network, all free. When you click on one, you get the abstract, like that, and you can, it says download, so you can click and download the paper. If you have old papers, put them up. If you have new papers to which you have the electronic version rights, put them up. If you have published papers and they have been in a journal for a while, ask the publisher for the electronic write back and put them up. Right? 28 million downloads all around the world. So cognitive science and cognitive linguistics now has a supplementary place for the publication, or rather the provision, of all your research. This is not to compete at all with journals that I help edit or that I work for. That's a different kind of thing. And you can put something up on the Cognitive Science Network and then later publish it in a journal. And if the journal accepts it and prints it, You can leave it on the Cognitive Science Network or take it down. No problem. You have all the rights. Now, the Cognitive Science Network comes with a wonderful set of search mechanisms. So suppose you are interested in, you know, clitics in French analytic causatives or some other linguistic topic. Suppose you're interested in iconicity in Chinese ideograms. You just type in the search engine what you're interested in, and up come all the papers in that field. It's really wonderful for me to see, because when I started in cognitive linguistics, the name did not exist. When I started in cognitive science, there was no field called cognitive science. Professors of cognitive science like myself all have degrees in something other than cognitive science, because those degrees did not exist. There were no journals. We used to print things up and mimeograph them and hand them out. I remember I had two copies of all of Lynn Talmy's papers. They were in blue mimeograph form. And I had one box on the east coast of the United States where I lived, and I had another box at my mother's house in San Diego where I was born. And I would tell people on both coasts, "Oh, you really need to know about fictive motion," or "you really need to know about rubber sheet topology and language." And they would say, "What?" And I would say, "Lynn Talmy." And they would say, "What?" Because, of course, these papers were published, much like Charles Fillmore's papers, often in places that were very, very hard to get to. But I had them in my boxes. And I would say, "Just a minute." And I would copy the paper and hand it to the person. So I was a distributor of articles of cognitive linguistics. But no more. Now we have journals. We have an international association. We have the Cognitive Science Network. So no need for me anymore to keep a box of papers at my mother's. I can just say, put them on the Cognitive Science Network. And this is really wonderful. An awful lot of work has been done by so many people to turn this into a worldwide discipline, and it's all available to you. We send out every week a little announcement of new work in cognitive linguistics. This is just an email list. This is the last one, May 15th. So here's some new research by Alan Chenky, by Karen Sullivan, by Anna Pleshakova, by Nathaniel Smith and Shweta Narayan. And you can just click and go and see the abstract, and if you're interested, read the paper. If you go to Google and type in Cognitive Science Network, you will see the Cognitive Science Network and the organizational page with the keywords comes up immediately. There it is. You just click. So it's not hard. You don't have to remember anything. Actually, you do have to remember two words. They are proper nouns. Everybody say Mark Turner. Come on, one more time again, Mark Turner. Good. If you go to markturner.org, you see this page, and you click right here, it says Cognitive Science Network. That's all you need to know. Mark Turner, you can get to the Cognitive Science Network. It will take you right there. So I believe that in looking at the presentations that will happen this afternoon, I am looking at tomorrow's research today. You are tomorrow's research today. And that is what the Cognitive Science Network is designed to provide. So, provide. Now, the title of today's lecture is Human Meaning. And that is a normal topic for cognitive linguistics because language is not independent of meaning. And moreover, the meaning that language depends upon is human meaning. It is the kind of meaning that is available for a human being. 50,000 years ago, more or less, during the Upper Paleolithic Age, archaeological evidence begins to amass of a radical transformation in the hominid, the Homo sapiens line. Now, of course we are on a climb with animals. Of course we share many, many things with mammals and with primates. Of course we do. But we are also strikingly different in our abilities. We have art, music, religion, fashions, symbols indicating social status, sign systems, mathematical insight, scientific discovery, advanced tool use, advanced social cognition. You were looking at me, and I am looking at you, and all each of us is seeing are some photons striking the retina and some longitudinal waves striking the ear. But it seems as if we can see what each other is thinking. I can try to figure out whether you're bored, in agreement, wishing I would switch topic, or not understanding my English, just by looking at your eyes and your gestures and how you hold yourself. This is radically distinctive in the social world. At the limits of their abilities, working in areas that are very central, like food and dominance, chimpanzees, with a lot of human help, seem to be able to get a little bit of this social cognition, just a little bit, to be able to understand that that chimpanzee, that conspecific, is a goal-directed agent, but not, for example, that it has false beliefs. So while it's important to recognize that we are on a climb with animals, the biggest scientific question is to explain why we are so different. We celebrate diversity all around the world. Good. The hard scientific question is to explain why there should be any. Let me explain that. The kinds of abilities we're talking about come up only in a blink of an eye, evolutionarily, just the last 50,000 years. Maybe 60, maybe 70, maybe 80. We are all captives of the archaeological record, and if they make a new discovery of a cave in Australia tomorrow, maybe we have to move the timeline a little. But that's not the point. The point is, there is evolutionarily a very recent change. Just this last little bit in human behavior. This sketch shows only the last 6 million years since the most recent common ancestor with the chimpanzee line, Pan Paniscus, and Pan troglodytes. That's your regular chimpanzee and the bonobo. Here's a reconstruction, two reconstructions of how this line might have gone, Homo erectus and Homo ergaster and so on. The point is, it's only in the top little teeny tiny slice, just a thin thread right at the top, that you see these behaviors that we all take for granted. Now, this is a great riddle. Why all of these behaviors should be here at all? They didn't have to be here for 2 billion years. Life got on just fine. They're brand new evolutionarily. Where did they come from? If you look at tool use, one of the things you see in the hominid line is that there were certain tool sets used in this line, in the Homo line and the hominid line. And by a tool set, I just mean like a rock that gets shattered so that there's a cutting edge and maybe a grinding part or something like that. There are tool sets that last in the evolution in our ancestors for hundreds of thousands of years, species-wide, without any change. No innovation, no creativity. Hundreds of thousands of years, not 4,000 years, hundreds of thousands of years, with no change, no invention, no creativity. This is as far as the species could get and hang on to. Now, if you give this tool set to a 3-year-old now, the 3-year-old will do something new with it in 15 minutes. That's what we can do. We are immensely creative, immensely innovative, immensely able to create emergent structure, to put together things that did not exist there before. And it is not cognitively costly. It is what we do all the time. Effortlessly, this is what we are built to do. Here are some other examples of this history. I simply want to make the point that the phenomena we are studying are very bizarre. They didn't have to be here. They are very recent. They only look recent to us because, you know, we don't live for 50,000 years, right? Now, we are used to diversity that comes from evolutionary creation of structure. So when we have different species, we are used to them behaving differently, of course. But those kinds of differences take very, very long evolutionary time to invent. So one group of great ape may eat one way, and another group of great ape may eat another way, and that's evolutionary. Not cultural. Cultural innovation is quite different, and it operates at lightning speed. Things can be invented in 15 seconds, 15 minutes, 15 years, 150 years, 15,000 years, which is nothing. To give you a contrast, think of the difference between Homo sapiens sapiens and lemur kata kata. Lemur kata kata is the ring-tailed lemur. Homo sapiens sapiens is all of us. We are the only subspecies of our species. And lemur kata kata is the only subspecies of the species lemur kata. So we look just like them, right? And the answer is no. If you look at ring-tailed lemurs in one valley, and you walk over the hill down to the other valley, they're just the same. Now, sometimes you see some differences in animals depending on what's in the environment. So if there is a lake, now you can wash your food, but if there's no lake on the other side of the hill, you can't wash your food. This is a difference, but it's a difference that's pushed by the environment. It's environmentally precipitated. And of course, there are variations. The female ring-tailed lemurs do not act exactly the way that the male ring-tailed lemurs operate, right? Of course. But the range of behaviors and structure available to ring-tailed lemurs is species-wide. Whereas for human beings, if you're in one valley and you walk over the hill down to another valley, They might speak a different language, wear different clothes, eat different food, eat differently. It might be that the things that were very diplomatic in one valley are very offensive in the other valley. We get these great variations that are not brought about by evolutionary biological provision of capacities to the entire species. I, for instance, am a speaker of English. I am not a speaker of Mandarin. It is not true that I, at my age, can form every sentence of Mandarin, including those that I have not heard. We have a capacity to develop structure. And the question is, what kinds of mechanisms give us that capacity? The story is pretty much true of the chimpanzee as well. Professor Wrangham has worked on whether or not chimpanzees have culture, and it is very impressive. Some chimpanzees have learned to use a chute to get the termites and eat them, others to wash the food in the water. But something I'd like you to remember, these inventive behaviors are attached to the most basic elements of being a chimpanzee, to eating, to reproduction, right? Feeding, fighting, fleeing, and reproduction. And they're very fragile. The offspring can pick them up, but they go away very easily. And there are only a few of them. Whereas for human beings, this is just what we do. If an anthropologist from Mars were to come here, we would look like just another great ape. And the reason for that is we are. In fact, we share the common mammalian brain, and the common mammalian brain is quite complicated. The human brain is not mush. Common mammalian brain has many pathways, a lot of structure, a lot of anatomical structure, and we have that because we are mammals. In fact, we share the common primate brain. So how can we be so different? What happened? Here's another example just to show that this is where human beings are located in the great ape lineage, right? We structurally and anatomically look just like the rest of them, pretty much. And in fact, anatomical human beings have been here for about 150,000 years. By anatomically modern human beings, I mean people who have the anatomical structure that we all have. Whereas cognitively modern human beings, that is, the ones who have all of our abilities, seem to have been here only about 50,000 years, maybe more. And I don't have a time machine. If I had a time machine for my birthday, I would go back. I know what I would do. If I had only one place I could go, I know where I would go. I would go back 50,000 years ago, and I would look at human beings and see what they could do. So what happened? Why is it that starting 50, 60, 70,000 years ago, you suddenly have art? You suddenly have all kinds of inventiveness and creativity. Well, the answer is because, I think, of the kinds of brains we have. Now, there have been many stories trying to explain where human beings could come from. Many stories of our origins. One, of course, from the Greeks, is the story of Prometheus and fire. That's where some other kind of agent, a god or an ancient astronaut, something that's more advanced than we are, brings us what we do not have, and we learn from them. And that's a good blend, because we learn from our parents, who can do what we cannot do. So why did the species not just learn from other agents that had those capacities? There is a legend I have read about a Chinese cave dragon who blew on monkeys and turned them into human beings. There's, of course, the anthropological... Oh, thank you. Now I have two cups of tea. See, these assistants are just amazing. I have to move to China. Thank you. Xie xie. This is the anthropological one, that we all come from Africa, of course, and a group of us got restless, and we decided to leave. And that out of Africa one and out of Africa two, that's what happened. Another is what I'm going to talk about, forbidden fruit blending. That is the development of a higher order capacity, mental operation, that is shared all the way back in the mammalian line in rudimentary fashions. And the story is, there are many cases in science where a small change in the causes produces a big change in the effects. And that is the story I'm going to start talking about today and introduce you to more fully this afternoon. You can find presentations of it in a book I wrote, The Literary Mind, The Origins of Thought and Language, and applications of it in a book, Cognitive Dimensions of Social Science. The most comprehensive presentation is in a book that Gilles Faulconnier and I wrote. Gilles, of course, was a speaker in this series before Chris Sinha. All of your questions, by the way, about this capacity called blending are answered at blending.stanford.edu. So you just go there and ask questions. It's all there, hundreds of papers. And here's Gilles. I only wish he were with us here, but he has been here before. So there are major questions that we're going to try to take on. And I think it's not bad to be ambitious, because we have to be. I think that our capacities come up together, and trying to explain them separately leads us to error. They come up together, phylogenetically it seems, they come up together ontogenetically. So we have to tackle them as a group. Language, art, music, mathematical insight, scientific discovery, religion, advanced social cognition, refined tool use, advanced music and dance. Have you ever noticed that your dogs don't dance? They will hop up and down with a human being if you train them to. And you can condition animals to almost anything. But have you ever noticed when the music is playing, the dog does not beat the time with its paw? There's nothing biologically stopping it. It has a paw, and it can move that paw. It could beat 3-4 times, it could do all kinds of things, but it doesn't. It's hard to realize that it doesn't, because we have seen so many cartoons and so many movies with dogs behaving in ways that dogs don't behave. We have seen so many representations of fictional animals, and it's so easy to project what we know of our minds into animals that it's very easy to over-assess what animals can do. Now, by the way, let me say, I'm very fond of animals, and we could talk for a very long time about how brilliant they are. Corvids, all those blue jays, scrub jays, New Zealand rooks, and their episodic memory and the ability to use a tool to get another tool. And so we could talk about that. Border collies who round up the sheep, all these kinds of things. Terciops truncatus, dolphins. So we can talk about that. I'm not overlooking the abilities of animals, on the contrary. But we have all of these things, which they do not have. What makes these behaviors possible? This is a big question. How do they work? How can new meanings arise? Now, evolution might very well give you a way to construe a situation. You see the big or any animal, you see your prey and you think, wow, there is lunch. Or you don't think, but you chase it down and you get it. You respond. Or a big scary animal makes a noise and comes at you and you run away. Yes, evolution can certainly provide these species-wide frames, some of them, that are tied to the local scale of your organismic and species behavior. But what human beings do is come up with new meanings all the time. They come up with new things all the time, new constructions all the time. How can they do that? How can new meaning arise? And how does the mind go beyond local scale? Now, I want to pause for just a second to impress this upon us, because I will come back to it again, and it is one of the major open questions in science. And that is, yes, other animals have some impressive abilities to do things like remember where they stored the nuts, or to interact with 3 or 4 agents and figure out that this is the one to be allied with while it's hunting that animal. Yes. But all of these behaviors are tied to the local moment, to the local scale, the visual field that we can see, small amount of time, few agents. When you see an animal doing something in that scale, that's great. But one of the things human beings do all the time is go beyond that scale. They remember when they were 5 years old. They construct a sense of personal identity that runs through their whole life. They think about their great-grandchildren who are not even here yet. They establish trust funds for their great-grandchildren who are not even here yet. They think about global warming. They think about international relations in areas that they have never been. They work at a scale of intentionality and time and space that's completely beyond the local species ability that we are evolved for, the local ability for which all other animals are captured. Yes, it is true, dolphins have signature whistles and seem to have some kind of genetic ability to recognize each other. Yes, it is true that the chimpanzee in the zoo, the special one, may store up the rocks to throw at the visitors tomorrow. And this is cited as, hey, wait a minute, animals are not tied completely into the local moment. Indul Tulving is the one who talked about mental time travel and how we can travel, right? But notice even that remarkable genius chimpanzee who stores those rocks, that's something very local. It's going to pick up the rocks and throw them. It's habit, it's routine, it's right there. The visitors are going to be on the other side of the gate. And it's an animal that is in a human environment with great regularity. But it can't get beyond that, right? That's as far as it goes. Now, how could human beings have developed this ability to go beyond human scale? Where does that come from? Well, we transcend local scale, and we're not talking about ways in which evolution can build in us abilities to go beyond local scale. So, for example, we don't need to know about nutrition to feel hunger, because evolution has built in us something at local scale, at local human scale, that will cause behavior that has long-range consequences, but we don't have to be aware of it. We do not have to be thinking about our great-great-grandchildren in order to feel attracted to a member of the opposite sex, because evolution has built desire into us at local scale that will have long-range consequences. That's not what I'm talking about. Of course evolution can do that. It does it for fish. It does it for, you know, seagulls. It does it for worms. It's a different question. How can we think about something that's far beyond our scale? Now, this is a bigger problem than we are likely to think. Charles Scott Sherrington, the great English neurophysiologist, pointed out that all you have, and of course we have each other and we have artifacts and we have things like that, but biologically, all you have is this central nervous system in your body. All you have is your biology. And your biology is always just now. It's always present. Your brain is an enchanted loom where millions of flashing shuttles weave a dissolving pattern. Always a meaningful pattern, though never an abiding one. A shifting harmony of sub-patterns. And with this present biological capability, you are able to have long-range thoughts. But how? How can you think of the past? Well, so that's one of our big questions for, major questions for these talks. Another is, where does new meaning come from? Where does new meaning come from? Now, there are some examples. Evolutionary psychology takes the standard evolutionary story that evolutionary descent can build in you, build in our species, a few frames of meaning. And that's true. It takes us for a good short, hard ride. It does not answer the question of where new meanings can come from, because mostly we come up with things on a time scale that is incredibly faster than evolution can possibly work. There's no evidence that basic mental operations of human cognition have changed in the last 50,000 years. But look at all the cultures and everything that has been developed, right? Another is learning theory, that you can extract schemata from the experience that you have, that you can get abstract schemata and then apply them to other things. That's pretty good. There's a problem, though, and that is a great deal of what exists in the world came up because we invented it and put it in the world. So it is not the case that we... restaurants did not get here because we saw a bunch of restaurants and extracted the schema. No, we had the idea for a restaurant and built them, right? Laws, institutions, we invented them and created them. So the story that you extract from your experience does not give us an explanation for how all these things got here before anybody experienced them. How did we create them in order to, how did we invent them mentally in order to know how to create them? Another, of course, is complexity theory of the sort that we study at the Santa Fe Institute. Humans are a complex, adaptive, self-organizing system, and I think there's a great deal of truth to that, and I'll be talking a little bit about how we have those capacities. Namely, I'll be talking about how we have those capacities through conceptual lending. So, going back to the reductionist story, the idea is that, well, human beings have some traits, and it looks like this. You've got religion in a box, and science in a box, and art in a box, and refined tool use in a box, and fashion, and language, and music, and so on. And maybe they're just different boxes for these. So I remind you of Ramachandran's caution against reductionism. I think, on the contrary, what happened, and I'll explain what blending is in a minute. On the contrary, what happened is that human beings invented a higher level of a basic mental operation. They evolved it. And once they had that, culture became possible. Once they had that, these various higher order mental capacities became possible. They had to be developed. Languages had to be developed. Art had to be developed. All these things had to be developed. Tools had to be developed. But then we had the capacity to do it. So the first sketch I made looked like this, but I thought, no, that's misleading because it looks as if they came up in sequence. So I made a different set of slides. So there's a climb of conceptual integration, otherwise known as blending. And we're at the top of it. We can do something called double scope blending. And once double scope blending got here, then all of these other abilities became possible. That is the overarching story for these major questions of where new meaning can come from and why we are so distinctive and what the role of language is. In particular, this group of abilities that human beings have, language, advanced social cognition, mathematical invention, and so on, should not be thought of independently. They should be thought of as a group, as a pack, as a coordinated and cooperating set of abilities that all are made possible by the same basic mental operation. Now, there are Cub Scouts all over the world. There are Boy Scouts all over the world. And there's a thing called the Cub Scout Law of the Pack. And this is for little children. There are Girl Scouts and there are Boy Scouts. And the Cub Scout law of the pack is the Cub Scout follows Akela. You don't need to know who Akela is. It's conceptual blending. The Cub Scout helps the pack go. And the pack helps the Cub Scout grow. So remember that. Any of these abilities is like one Cub Scout. And it helps the pack go. It helps all the others develop. And the pack helps the Cub Scout grow. Now, this is along the lines of this recontextualization that Professor Erhartz had talked about. I want to make it clear just this once in this set of talks that This is not a triumphal story. Mostly in discussing human abilities, we sound positive and proud. Look at human beings. They invented complex numbers. They launched rockets into space. They circumnavigated the globe. They can paint, right? But it is also the case that our species has great sorrow and great suffering and great psychopathology. There's no evidence that any other species spends 20 years being paralyzed with guilt for something they didn't do in one moment when they were a teenager, or that they construct fantasies in which terrible things happen and they feel bad, right? Human beings think of the counterfactuals. They think of the hypothetical. They think of what isn't and what might have been and things they might not be. And they think of things at great scale. And this brings great sorrow and great suffering. And Rilke noticed this. He wrote in the Duino Elegies, "The shrewd animals notice that we're not very much at home in the world we've expanded." And this is true. Cognitive science and cognitive linguistics, let's just make it very clear, is not a story of triumph. It is a story of the human condition. And it comes with many wonderful things and many things that are hard. So now, let me tell you what conceptual blending is, and then we'll talk about it this afternoon, and I'll take questions. So imagine that there is a man who is in a wedding. He's a groomsman. He's helping. And he's in San Diego, where a mental space is an array of meaning, of compacted meaning, fairly simple, that you can manipulate online in the moment of thinking and acting. But while he is at this wedding, he is thinking of the fact that 3 weeks ago, he was diving with his girlfriend off Cabo San Lucas looking for treasure. And now his girlfriend is not here at the wedding. So we automatically have a big scientific problem. Why should a human being be able to think simultaneously of two stories that do not correspond to each other, that are in conflict to each other? Shouldn't evolution shut this down? But notice, he does not get confused. He does not swim down the aisle, even though in the blue space he's swimming. He talks normally, even though in the diving he's got something in his mouth. He does not mistake the bride for a shark. Well, if you're able to call these things up, what stops you from getting confused? This is such a big problem in cognitive science that Arthur Glenberg in 1997 wrote a brilliant paper called What Memory Is For, in which he said, mostly memory in other species seems to be subordinated to what we're doing now. So if you want to remember how, if you want to get out of the forest, you can remember how you got in. But you don't hallucinate. You think of what you need for the moment. But human beings all the time can call up multiple stories. And Terry Deacon has been working on this problem now along some of the lines of the blending work for about 8 years. This is a big, big problem. But they can do more. We can make vital relation connections between mental spaces. So the man at the party, at the wedding, can make a frame relationship or an analogy relationship between the bride and his girlfriend, and between the groom and himself, for example. And then he can engage in selective projection. That is, he can take parts of each mental space and project them to a new imaginative mental space, a blended mental space. And in there, he can think that he's marrying his girlfriend right here. He's not deluded. He knows that this is a fantasy, right? But he can think about it. He can say, you know, that's a pretty good idea. I never thought of that before. I will make a plan to achieve that. That's creativity. That's emergent structure. He's coming up with something that he's never seen before, namely marrying his girlfriend. And he can like it. He can also realize that you know, as he's running the simulation, and the officiant says to his girlfriend, the bride, do you take this man to be your lawfully wedded husband? That maybe she would say, I would never marry you. And he can see that it's true, and that in some ways he hasn't been thinking properly. Now, there's selective projection. Only some of what's in these input mental spaces comes into the blend. And there's emergent structure. Namely, here he's marrying his girlfriend, right here on this scene. This is what we do all the time. This is what we're capable of all the time. It seems remarkable here because I'm giving you a visible example. But in fact, this kind of blending happens all the time. 99.99% of blends are never noticed by the people making them. So this is the subject of The Way We Think. And I want to give you a riddle, and then I'll stop. A riddle that is an example of a blend. It's the riddle of the Buddhist monk, which is an old riddle. Carl Duncker used this riddle in psychology. So here's the riddle. It's a riddle for you, a brain teaser. A Buddhist monk begins at dawn every day, one day. One day, he begins at dawn walking up a mountain. He reaches the top at sunset, and he meditates at the top overnight. Until, at dawn, he begins to walk back to the foot of the mountain, which he reaches at sunset. Now, you can make no assumptions about whether he starts or stops along the way, how fast he goes at one point, whether he stops to smell the flowers, whether he backtracks a little to pick up a stone and then goes back up. No such assumptions. Just that he travels on the path, and he starts at dawn, and he ends at sunset. Okay? Now, riddle, is there a place on the path which the monk occupies at the same hour of the day on the two separate journeys? So here's a little example. Here's a Buddhist monk. And he walks, he starts at dawn, and he walks up to the top, he reaches it at sunset, sits down, meditates overnight until dawn comes again, he gets up, and he walks back down the mountain path, reaching the bottom at sunset. Okay? So let's see this again. Starts at dawn, goes up the mountain path. However he goes, reaches the top at sunset, sits down, meditates overnight until dawn comes around, he gets up and he goes back down the path and reaches the bottom at sunset. Okay? Now the question is, you may not know what point it is, but is there a point on the path that he occupies at the same hour of the day on the two separate days? And I will answer that riddle. You will answer that riddle. I will put you in a position to see the answer to that riddle at 3:30. And we will explore how you did it as an example of conceptual blending, selective projection, emergent meaning, and the basic mental operation that makes language possible. Thank you, Shishi. We will now take some questions, if you like. Okay?